The issue, the part that put before me this morning is whether or not debtors chapter 13 plan was proposed in good faith. We all know that a chapter 13 plan must be proposed in good faith under section 1325A3 in the Eighth Circuit. An analysis of good faith under section 1325A3 is focused on whether the plan constitutes an abuse of the provisions, purpose, or spirit of chapter 13. That's from Handeen v. Lemaire, 898 F2nd 1346 1348, 8th Circuit, 1990, citing United States v. Estes, 695 F2nd 311 316, 8th Circuit, 1982. The primary purpose of the bankruptcy statute is the collection and distribution of the debtor's estate to his creditors. A secondary purpose is to discharge the debtor's financial obligations. That's Lemaire at 1352. In other words, it's not just about the debtor. To determine whether good faith exists, the bankruptcy court must consider the totality of the circumstances. That's Lemaire at 1348. In Estes, the Eighth Circuit provided a non-exclusive list of 11 factors the bankruptcy court should consider. I emphasize non-exclusive list. That's Lemaire at 1349, footnote 4. The 1984 amendments to the bankruptcy code subsumed many of those factors and narrowed the focus of the bankruptcy court's inquiry to whether the debtor has stated his debts and expenses accurately, whether he has made any fraudulent representation to mislead the bankruptcy court, or whether he has unfairly manipulated the bankruptcy code. That's Lemaire at 1349, citing Education Assistance Corp. versus Zellner, 827 F2nd 1222, 8th Circuit, 1987. An argument could be made that Lemaire and Zellner are no longer good law following the 2005 amendments to the bankruptcy code, because a subjective analysis of a debtor's financial circumstances under section 1325A3 is now a necessary complement to the subjective analysis of a debtor's financial circumstances under section 707B3B. Refer the parties to the In re McGillis case, 370BR720 at 746 to 747. That's a bankruptcy decision out of the Western District of Michigan in 2007. However, assuming they are still good law, the Eighth Circuit preserved parts of Estes's totality of the circumstances approach, and factors such as the type of debt sought to be discharged and whether the debt is non-dischargeable in a Chapter 7, and the debtor's motivation and sincerity in seeking Chapter 13 relief continue to be particularly relevant. That's Lemaire at 1349, again citing Zellner. Consideration must also be given to the sincerity of the debtor in putting forth his Chapter 13 plan, and whether that plan demonstrates real sincerity on the part of the debtor to repay his creditors as best he can. That's Banks v. Vandiver, 248BR799-803, 8th Circuit BAP 2000, citing In re Kurtz, 238BR826-830, Bankruptcy District, North Dakota, 1999. The ultimate question is whether the debtor is making an honest attempt to repay his creditors. In re Larson, 245BR609 at 616, Bankruptcy District of Minnesota, 2000. I can think of no better evidence of debtor's sincerity or lack of sincerity than her proposed treatment of her unsecured creditors. Actions do speak louder than words. Having heard debtor's testimony and having observed her demeanor while on the witness stand, I am firmly convinced debtor is motivated not by a sincere desire to repay her creditors, but by the desire to maintain her previous and generous, if not lavish by South Dakota standards, standard of living while paying only the absolute minimum required to shed her unsecured debt. That may not evidence bad faith, and I want to make it clear that I am not saying that debtor is a bad person. But debtor is not required to show her plan was not proposed in bad faith. She is required to show it was proposed in good faith, and she hasn't done that. Debtor's annual income is nearly $115,000. but she proposes to pay her unsecured creditors only $339.77 a year under her original plan, or $1,430.80 per year under the plan that was discussed this morning. That does not evidence a sincere desire to repay her creditors. Moreover, according to her Schedule J, debtor spends, for a family of two, $600 per month for food, $200 per month for clothing, $150 per month for recreation, $150 per month for charitable contributions, $190 per month for cable, telephone, and internet, $200 per month for her cell phone, $108 per month for lawn care and snow removal, $145 per month for pet care, $100 per month for haircuts, license, registration, and gifts, $50 per month for school meals, in addition to the $600 per month for food previously mentioned, $502.49 for private school tuition, uniforms, and tutoring, in addition to the $200 per month for clothing previously mentioned, $708 per month for child care for her daughter, who would seem to be old enough to require only minimal child care, and $225 per month for her daughter's activities, fees, and camps. It does not take a great deal of imagination to think of ways debtor could reduce her spending for the benefit of her creditors, but she has made no real effort to do so. That does not evidence a sincere desire to repay her creditors either. Most significantly, debtor proposes to retain a house that she values at $260,000, the trustee values at $300,000, and that may have been purchased for $290,000, by making monthly payments of more than $2,500 per month. When the IRS standards allow her only $858 per month for housing, when she has no equity in the house, which is over-encumbered by nearly $30,000 to protect or preserve, which also means she's paying $30,000 more than the house is worth to keep it, and when her unsecured creditors will receive virtually nothing under the plan, and as Trustee Wine noted, less than the amount debtor spends each month on her pet. That does not evidence a sincere desire to repay her creditors either. If we are looking for something above and beyond the ability to pay, which is the discussion that I found in the Nebraska cases, I think the proposal to retain the house under those circumstances provides that additional element. I don't agree with those cases, however, because I think that, as I noted earlier, the debtor's proposal for treating her unsecured creditors is necessarily the best evidence of her sincerity in proposing to repay those creditors. Good faith requires the debtor's best efforts, and debtor's plan falls far short of debtor's best efforts. Considering the totality of the circumstances, I cannot find debtor's plan is proposed in good faith, and confirmation must therefore be denied. I am not addressing the feasibility issue this morning because that objection was not raised in connection with the original plan. If debtor files a modified plan and seeks confirmation of that, however, obviously feasibility will be a concern given her financial situation. We will enter an order accordingly. We're adjourned.